This is an audio recording for Physics 142 for the class of September 18th, 2008. If you'd be good enough to download the PDF file, which contains the slides, I'll be referring to that throughout the lecture. I'll be referring to page numbers, which you will find in the light blue color on the upper right of each page, and we're going to start clearly with page one. Now, last time we talked a good bit more about Gauss's law and how powerful it is. Gauss's law, which is the integral over any surface area of E dot dA, is equal to the charge enclosed over epsilon naught, is really always true. It's a general rule. And the reason it's so important for us is that under particular conditions of symmetry, namely where Q enclosed and E dot dA are relatively simple to determine, this law can allow us to calculate the electric field in situations where calculating the electric field in a brute force manner might be rather difficult. Now, in order to calculate Gauss's law, the particular situations which are useful often involve curvilinear coordinates. So last time we talked a bit about curvilinear coordinates. And what I have pictured at the bottom of page one are the coordinate system that we use for spherical. This is the spherical polar coordinate system. It's something that's useful for situations with spherical symmetry. So the real trick in using this is to realize that if I pick a particular volume element within a spherically symmetric system, what you really want to do is to pick something such as in the drawing on the lower right. You can see pictured a differential volume element, dV, and that volume element has a side which is equal to dr in terms of its thickness. You can think of it as taking a little piece of an annular shell. And if we make use of the fact that s is equal to r theta, and you look at the geometry, you can convince yourself that the other sides of this box-like differential volume are going to be r sine theta d phi and r d theta. So the total differential volume is dv equal to r squared sine theta d phi dr. Now this is a little bit hard for me to do via just audio because I'd like to point some things out. There are ways to get around that. I can label the various pieces with numbers and refer to them by that. But I think it's not worth my while because presumably I did that on September 16th for the lecture then. And all I want to do is to remind you of it here. If we go to page 2, in a similar way, the differential volume for a cylinder goes as r d phi dz dr. And in general, I limit us to a single variable. So if you need to do an integral that has cylindrical symmetry of some form, it could actually have a symmetry that varies in phi, z, and r, in which case you quite literally have to do an integral over all three variables. I'm going to limit us to problems where we're only doing one variable. In particular, what we'll generally see is in cylindrical problems, I will have variation only in r, the distance from the central axis of the cylinder. And in spherical problems, I'll also have things that only vary as a function of r. So what this means is that you will not need to do the integrals in theta and phi. And you can work in annular shells, either cylindrical or spherical, where you can basically look at the area and think of it as of a shell, and then think of it as being dr thick. and that will be the differential volume element that you want to deal with, and you can only do the integral. Then you only have to do the integral in one variable. So if we look at the bottom of page 2, you can see what I'm talking about. In the spherical case, on the left-hand side, the differential volume, if we assume that we only have variation of the quantity that you're integrating over in R, you can actually mentally go ahead and integrate over the two angular pieces and basically think of having a spherical surface which has an area of 4 pi r squared, where whatever it is you're integrating over is constant on that spherical surface, and then you allow that surface to expand a distance dr, and you have that spherical shell be your differential volume dv. And so using this mental game, you already integrated over the angular pieces, and you still allow yourself to have a differential dependence in the direction where things are actually changing, which in this case will be the r direction. In cylindrical geometries, generally we assume that the thing, whatever it is you're integrating over, basically is infinite in length along z. You may work with a particular element L that often will just cancel out in Gauss's law, so don't worry about it too much if you don't actually know what the length is. You sort of have to put it in order to calculate things, and it usually will cancel out. At any rate, if we look at the cylindrical geometry on page 2, the differential volume that you want to deal with is a piece that basically has the area of a cylindrical pipe, which is 2 pi r times dr, and then we do have to give it a length because we have to deal with a volume, so that's why the L is thrown in. So the differential volume is going to be 2 pi r L, and then you push it out a differential dr to get that other dimension. And the integral will be only over dr in this case. And like I say, L you may not know, because usually in these problems they're set up to have an infinite extent along z so that the symmetry takes out all other components of the fields or things that you're calculating instead of R. But Gauss's law, sort of, you still have to deal with the volume, so you have to put in some arbitrary length, but since that usually comes in on both sides, it cancels out. So let's go to page 3. Now, in page 3, what I'd like to do is to actually do an example. So in the drawing on the left, upper left, what you see is the cross-section of a coaxial cable of some form. So the inner piece, which has a radius less than big R sub A, if we look at the middle drawing. So let's look at the middle drawing, actually, on page 3. And if you cut through this coaxial cable and look at it face on, what you see is that we have a radius R sub A, radius R sub B, and a radius R sub C, where R sub C is bigger than R sub B, which is bigger than R sub A. And in this particular case, so what you see in the drawing up above is just a slightly different angle, which is often used for these types of problems to show you that, in fact, you also have, it's not a spherical problem, but one that has, it's a cable, it's something that has a cylindrical geometry. So that's why you see the kinds of drawings that you see up on the top. At any rate, in this particular problem, let us suppose that we have a non-conducting core to this pipe. So in the region where we have a radius, in the region where R is less than R sub A, let us suppose that there is a charge per unit length which is distributed in such a way that it depends on the radius. So the charge distribution given by the equation where I have the A in a circle, rho sub R goes as little a, which is just a constant, times R. So it has an R dependence. And now the question is to find E in all space, the region between radius A and radius B is, think of it as a vacuum. There's nothing there. And then the region between R sub B and R sub C, let's call that, let's say that's a conductor, some sort of a conducting sheath. So to do this problem, where we want to find the electric field in all space, just like other Gauss's law problems, you have to first select the relevant regions of space due to the symmetry. From the symmetry of this problem, we will clearly would like to use cylindrically symmetric Gaussian surfaces. And the reason you want to use cylindrically symmetric Gaussian surfaces is that the electric field, by the symmetry of this problem, is going to be pointed out radially away from the central axis of this pipe. And because of that, if your Gaussian surface has cylindrical symmetry with the symmetry axis, with the central axis along the axis of the pipe, the electric field will be pointing out along the radial direction of the Gaussian surface. It will vary only with the radius. So on the pipe surface, the round surface of the Gaussian surface that you choose, electric field will be constant because it's all at a fixed radius, and then the electric field and dn for any area element of that part of the Gaussian surface will be parallel, so the dot product is trivial, which means that the integral of E dot dA becomes the integral of E times dA, and E is constant and can just pull out of the integral. And then the area of a cylinder you can figure out. For the end caps, they both drop out of the problem because E dot dA or E dot n is zero because E is perpendicular to n hat for each of the end caps, where n hat is going to be pointing along the axis of the cylinder. Okay, so you divide your Gaussian surface up into three parts. If we look at the bottom of page 3, let us consider the region R less than R sub A. And the Gaussian surface we're choosing, if you look at it head on, is shown just as the left-hand drawing at the bottom of page 3. The Gaussian surface has a little radius R, which is going to be less than the big radius R sub A. If we look at it from the other view, you can see that the Gaussian surface we're choosing is a little cylinder, basically, that has a radius inside of R sub A. If we go to page 4, what we'd like to do is, always we start out with Gauss's law, which is general and always valid. Gauss's law is the sum of E dot dA, the integral of E dot dA, over all of the surface of the volume that we choose. And the Gaussian surface that we choose is at the bottom pictured. It's a Gaussian surface, cylindrical, with radius little r and a length big L. The end caps don't contribute because E is perpendicular to dA, so we only have to worry about the pipe shell. And E dot dA, the integral of E dot dA, becomes the magnitude of E times the integral of dA, and that just is the area of this the shell piece, the round piece of the pipe, which is 2 pi r times the length, big L. The other side of Gauss's law is charge enclosed in this Gaussian volume. That's the integral of rho dV, and in this case, what you want to think of is dV, because you have a cylindrical surface. Little dV is pictured up in the upper right-hand corner of page 4. Because we have no angular dependence, you can think of dV as being a little cylindrical shell, which has a volume of 2 pi r times the length of the shell times thickness dr, which gives you the little differential piece. So the integral of rho dv becomes the integral of rho times 2 pi r l dr, but rho is equal to little a times r, because the charge is increasing as you go out in the radius. And we want to see how much of this charge is actually inside the Gaussian surface. So if you look at the equation where I have the pink B in a circle, you can see that the limit of the, what we want to do is integrate over the volume between, for the radius from 0 out to little r, because the Gaussian surface has a radius little r, of AR 2 pi RL DL, DR, sorry. So A in the line below on the right-hand side, line below the equation with the pink B in a circle, the constants pull out A 2 pi L, and I'm integrating 0 to R squared DR, which will be R cubed, little r cubed over 3. So the total charge enclosed is going to be A 2 pi L little r cubed over 3, which is the equation in the lower right-hand part. So if we go to page 5, I can now set the left-hand side of Gauss's law equal to the right-hand side of Gauss's law. So the left-hand side, we found the integral of E dot dA was equal to the absolute magnitude of E times 2 pi r L. And that's equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught, and Q enclosed we evaluated to be A 2 pi L r cubed over 3. So the right-hand side becomes A 2 pi L r cubed over 3 all over epsilon naught. And then we can just solve for the electric field. Now, you'll note that in the upper equation on page 5, I have the magnitude of the electric field. And in the second equation, I have algebraically solved for the magnitude of the electric field, but then I've actually left it as a vector and taken out the magnitude signs. But in doing so, what I've done is I have given you a direction when I did that, because I know that in this problem, the electric field is going to be radially outward. And you say outward or inward. If we look on page 3 in the problem, I've specified the charge per unit length to have a positive sign, so I know that it's radially outward. If I didn't give you a sign for lambda, you could put radially with inward or outward depending on the relative sign of lambda, for example. So this then, on page 5, the equation signified by the pink A in a circle is the answer for R less than R sub A. The second region to consider is the region between radius R sub A and radius R sub B. And in this region, we have no charge. We go through exactly the same procedure. We draw another Gaussian surface. This time the relevant Gaussian surface that we want to draw is one which has a radius little r between R sub A and R sub B. So we want to make it in the region of interest now. And again, we evaluate the integral of E dot dA on this little Gaussian surface. And by all the arguments that we used in the first region, the answer of that is going to be the magnitude of E times 2 pi RL, because the field will be radially along the radial direction in this region, and it will be constant at a given R by the symmetry of the problem. On the right-hand side, the charge that's enclosed is going to be the charge within the cylinder with radius R sub A of length L. So the answer to this is going to To evaluate QEnclosed, it's exactly like evaluating QEnclosed at the bottom of page 4, except the radius r is going to be not little r, but big R sub a, because as I sum over the entire, back on page 5, as I sum over the entire Gaussian volume with radius little r, I'm only getting charge out to radius r sub a. So the answer for the right-hand side of Gauss's law is going to be Q enclosed, which is going to be a 2 pi l r sub a cubed over 3 divided by epsilon naught. Again, I now can solve for the magnitude of E, and because of the symmetry of the problem and the fact that lambda is positive, I know it will have to be radially outward. So at the top of page 6 in the equation, which is shown next to the pink A in a circle, you see that E is radially outward, and it's equal to A over epsilon naught times RA cubed over 3R. To the right of that, in the equation signified with the B in a circle, I show you the equation for R less than R sub A. So you'll note, because the charge enclosed in the Gaussian surface is increasing, if R is less than R sub A, it's increasing as little r increases all the way out to R sub A. The electric field is actually growing as the square of the radius as you move out. But then when you get to consider little r greater than R sub A, so you're in the region between R sub A and R sub B, the electric field is going to fall off, because as the radius grows of the Gaussian surface, you're getting further away from the charge and you're no longer enclosing any more charge. Boy, this is pretty awful. I imagine it's rather boring for you. It's hard for me to figure out how to make jokes if I'm just sort of sitting here at my desk in my office talking to myself. I suspect my neighbors think I'm pretty strange right now, listening to me mumbling to myself. At any rate, in order to complete the problem, we have to consider two more regions. One is the region in between R sub B and R sub C, and the other is going to be the region R sub C greater than R sub C. So, in the region R sub B is less than little r is less than R sub C, the Gaussian surface that we include is going to be given by the drawing that you see on page 6. This Gaussian surface resides inside a conductor, and we know that the electric field inside a conductor is zero. So in this case, the integral of E dot dA is going to be zero everywhere. So that means that the total charge enclosed is going to be zero. So what happens is that we know that the conductor, or the region less than R sub A in the middle of this problem, contains a net charge, and there is a non-zero electric field between R sub A and R sub B. But we have to have zero electric field inside the conductor. So what happens is the electric field produced by the inner piece induces a separation of charge on the outer conducting sheath, such that the right amount of charge resides on the inside at radius R sub B to cancel out the field lines. So the answer for the third region of space, the region R sub B less than R is less than R sub C, is that the electric field is just zero there. Finally, we get to the region on page 7 of little r greater than R sub C. And the Gaussian surface is given by the orange dashed line shown in the drawing beside the pink A. Now, if we think about this case, the total charge enclosed is really the same as what we had when we did the second region. The total charge enclosed is going to be the total charge enclosed by the cylinder with radius r sub a, because we've had no other charge, net charge, added in, basically. Remember that the conducting sheath with a radius between r sub b and r sub c starts out with net charge of zero, and all that happens is that we separate that charge, so the charge resides on the inside of that conducting sheath and on the outside of the conducting sheath, but the net charge is zero. So what that means is when I look at a Gaussian surface outside of that region, the charge that's on the conducting sheath doesn't contribute, because you have as much positive as you have negative. The only net charge that contributes is going to be exactly that charge, which is less than radius r sub a. So by the symmetry and the fact that Q enclosed is the same, it means that when we go to a radius r sub c, the solution will be exactly like that which we saw at the top of page 6 by the pink A in the circle. That is, the electric field will be A times R sub A cubed over epsilon naught 3 times little r, and it's going to be radially outward. So in this case, inside R sub A, the electric field grows as R squared. Then in the regions R sub B to R sub C, and the region greater than R sub C, the electric field is simply dropping off as 1 over R, where R is the distance from the center of the cylinder. Okay, so I hope you could follow this discussion with all of these ridiculous R's. This may actually be a rather difficult example to follow using just audio, since I'm not pointing to all the various radii as I say them for you. So that's a shame, but well, hopefully it'll work okay. But clearly you will want to email me with questions, and also I will give you the opportunity to ask questions next Tuesday. All right, let's go to page 8. If you recall from mechanics, you learned about forces, springs, and balls falling in a gravitational field, and you looked one of the things that you, I hope, recall learning is that if we look at changes of energies in those mechanical systems, we were able to learn a lot about the system, and sometimes we were able to figure out how to do things in ways that were much simpler. The bottom line as to why gravitation and springs were simple is that the energy in the system when the system would change, such as the ball would fall through a given height or the spring would be compressed through a given amount, the energy, potential energy in the system, would depend only on the end positions. So if the ball falls a distance h, we knew that the gain in kinetic energy is just equal to the change in the potential energy, mgh. And the reason that this is true is basically that gravitation is a conservative force. And we also found that springs are conservative. They're ideal springs, and we don't have any friction. It turns out that we have a similar thing with electrostatics, and I want to examine that now. I hope you remember that, in fact, using energy allowed us to do all sorts of calculations in a way that was much easier than doing the integrals that we would have had to do with springs and gravitation. So I want to now consider the electric field and energy. So to do this, what I want to do is to imagine that we have a charge plus Q. So if you look at the drawing on the left-hand side of page 8, imagine that we have this charge plus big Q that generates an that has an electric field given more or less by the red arrows pointing radially outward. And in order to examine energy in the system, let's imagine that we have a little test charge, little Q0, which is shown next to the orange Roman numeral 1 in a circle. And if I have that little charge Q0, which let's say that it starts at position A, and I move it from A to B, then I could ask the question, how much work do I do to move that charge, little Q0, from position A to position B? So we can imagine that since the electric field is outward, just mentally we can imagine that Q0 is a positive charge. It doesn't necessarily have to be, but let's say that it is. Then I know that there will be a force on Q0, which is actually radially outward because the electric force goes as QE. So the force that I have to exert in order to move the charge from point A to point B is given by the green F next to the drawing on the right. Okay, the amount of work that I have to do is given by the formulas at the bottom of page 8. The work will be the integral of F dot ds, where ds is a differential element of a differential displacement along the direction of motion for this charge charge Q0. So work is always integral of F dot ds between the endpoints, and so work goes from point A to point B of F dot ds. For simplicity, let's assume that I move along the radial direction right now. So the integral, that means that F and ds, remember, because I'm evaluating the force that I do, so the F is the force that I exert, and ds is displacement element along the direction of motion, and they're both parallel because they're both radial and they're both going in. So the integral, the vector piece, the vector dot product F dot ds just becomes F times ds. F, if we assume that I'm not accelerating the charge but basically just keeping it from zooming out radially, and I move it inward with sort of differential slowness, no acceleration involved, I know that F is going to be, so it's always equilibrium, so the F that I have to produce is always Q0 times E. So if you look at the equations on the bottom of page 8 and you look at the third element in the equation, fourth, so W is equal to F dot ds, which is equal to the integral of F ds, we have the integral from A to B of Q0 times E times ds. Well, ds is a differential displacement vector along the radial direction, but the way that I've defined it here, moving from point A to point B, it's going inward. I'd like to do an integral along r, so I want to convert ds into a dr element, but if ds is positive going inward, then I have to bring in a minus sign if I convert ds into dr. So ds is equal to minus dr. So in the last part of equation 8, I make a couple of changes. I basically am converting from going from points A to B to points R sub A to R sub B, and I'm converting from ds into dr. So the work integral becomes minus the integral from R sub A to R sub B of Q0 times E times dr. So if we go to page 9, I evaluate that integral. So the electric field of a point charge, I know it's kq over r squared. And the kq pull out and means that I'm doing an integral of 1 over r squared. So on the top equation on page 9 to the right, I have minus kq0 big Q times the integral of 1 over r squared, which is minus 1 over r, evaluated between the radii a and b. So if you go to the second line on page 9, the answer is that the work is equal to the two charges times k times 1 over r sub b minus 1 over r sub a. Now r sub b is smaller than r sub a, which means the 1 over r sub b is bigger than 1 over r sub a, which means this quantity is net positive, which means it basically, if intuitively, you know that if I have a positive test charge q0 and I move it toward a big charge plus q, it's going to take work on my part. So it's a good thing this turned out to be positive. So I have figured out how much work it takes me to move a charge in an electric field. And just like in mechanics, where what you find is that it very often isn't an absolute energy that's useful, it's usually the changes in energy that are important in problems. And very often you're able to define a zero for potential energy, for example, and then look at changes in potential energy in order to get at problems. We do exactly that in electromagnetism. What's really relevant is the change in energy or the change in work that I do. Now, you'll note that the work that I've done in this, then that we evaluated to be what you see in the second line on page 9, it depends on the little q0. So that means that how much work I ever do in an electromagnetic system in moving a charge will depend on the charge that I move around. And you don't really want that to be the case. What you'd like to have is a measure of how much energy it would take to move any charge around in an electrostatic field. So what we do is, instead of just looking at the change in work, we look at the change in work per unit charge as we move it around, and we define this to be the potential difference. Okay, so potential is really a powerful word, right? What does it mean in English? You know, if somebody asks you, what is your potential? If you have a grandma who looks at you and says, oh, you have a lot of potential. You know, your grandma's thinking, oh, you can go to graduate school, you can go to medical school, you can be a lawyer, you know, you're going to do great things. It's not that you have done these things. It is that you have within you, in your grandmother's opinion, the ability to do that. If you walk into a party, right, and you see some good-looking person on the other side of the room, and you go, ha, 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 that person's got some potential. You know, what do you really mean? It's not that you are doing anything about it. You're just sort of looking at this person and thinking, well, under certain circumstances, things could happen, right? So we use the word potential the same way in physics here. Potential difference is not a measure of the amount of work that you do to move from one point to another necessarily. It's sort of the measure of how much work you could do if you moved a certain amount of charge from one place to another and multiplied it by the potential difference, right? So that's sort of, it's a measure of, you can think of it as sort of a characteristic of the space. A given charge distribution will create within space sort of a region of specific potential differences. You know, once I have in space a certain situation, If I put a test charge at point A and I move it to point B, then the amount of work it will take is going to be the potential difference between those two points times the amount of charge that I'm actually moving. All right? I don't know whether all of that helps or hurts, but if it hurt, just think of potential difference as the amount of work it takes to move a given charge per unit charge. Okay? And because how do you relate this to the potential energy of the system? Well, a way to think about it, if you recall that when I have the positive charge Q and I have a little positive Q0 at some distance A away from charge big Q, and I move the little charge in toward big Q, I have had to do positive work. You can think of that as having increased the potential energy of the system. Okay. So, how do I know I've increased the potential energy of the system? If I were to let that little charge Q go, it's going to go off to infinity with a bigger velocity than it would if I had started it further out from big charge Q. So I know that within the system there's more stored energy. The work that's done maybe this will become obvious as we keep moving. I'm trying to justify the minus sign that you see when we look at potential difference and potential and work and potential energy. The work per unit charge goes as minus the potential energy per unit charge. You can think of it that way. I do a positive work, and that means I actually increase the potential energy of a system, but the work that's done by the charge itself is going to be negative in that case. So that's sort of where this minus sign comes in. Just to make sure that we manage to keep people nice and confused, potential difference is signified many, many different ways. Sometimes it's a delta V, sometimes it's V sub B minus V sub A if you have endpoints A and B. Sometimes it's VAB, V sub AB, for example. And the units of potential difference are, it's a work per unit charge, so it has to be a joule per coulomb in the MKS system. And we define that to be the volt. And this is in celebration of some guy named Volta, and I'll show you his picture next Tuesday. Let's move to page 10. If you recall in mechanics, in a sliding board problem, for example, we have to worry about changes in height. And sometimes in a problem, you aren't given an absolute height, so you might have difficulty figuring out what's important. You may not have an absolute height of the sliding board, for example, but what is important is the changes in height. So it doesn't actually matter where you define the zero of height, because the changes will always be invariant. So as you know, in terms of height, we have an arbitrary definition worldwide of sea level as being sort of the zero of height. Some mountain or some building is so many meters above sea level. And in the problems, it's only changes that are important. The same thing is really true in electrostatics, but typically what happens is we define a zero for the potential, and what's important, of course, is the changes in potential, but the calculations are sometimes It's useful to think of, in many cases, there being an absolute zero somewhere. And so you have arbitrary freedom in any problem you face in electromagnetism to define the absolute potential at any given point, at some point, to be a given number, usually a zero. But sometimes it's a fixed number. Okay, so so let's look at a particular problem on page 10. We have our charge big Q, and I want to move the charge in from point A to point B, but now I'm going to have point A be at infinity. So I'm basically bringing a charge in from infinity to point B. So the work that we do, the work per unit charge, is going to be K times big Q, remember that we're dividing the little Q out, times 1 over R sub B minus 1 over R sub A. In this case, R sub A becomes infinite. So this term, the right-hand term on the equation in the middle of page 10, is 0. So the work per unit charge, or the potential at radius R sub B, is going to be just equal to KQ over R sub B. So although it is only potential differences that are actually important, we talk about the potential of a point charge, for example. If you just have a point charge in a system, and you were to define the potential at infinity to be zero, then you can think of the radius, the radial distance that you are from the point charge Q, to define an absolute potential, which is KQ over little r. So we think of that as the potential of a point charge. You just have to remember, and this is a very useful formula, the thing which is outlined in the red on page 10. The potential at point r is KQ over r for a point charge, but you need to remember that in using that, you have defined the potential at infinity to be zero. One of the things that makes potential so useful, and the same is true for springs and for gravitation, is that potential is a scalar. You know, its potential is a work per unit charge, and work is an integral of force dotted into distance. So that scalar product, you take those two vectors and you change this thing into a scalar. So it's just a number. So if I think of the potential of a point charge as KQ over R, I can see that it is possible to calculate how much work it takes to move it from one radius to any other radius just by looking at the differences in the potential using this formula. And nobody has to worry about direction. It only depends on the actual radius. So it is much simpler to calculate than, say, electric field differences and things like that. So let's go to page 11 and look at the potential of a distribution of discrete charges. Imagine that we are considering the potential in space at point P, which is which has a distribution of charges, Q1, which is at a distance given by vector R1 to point P, Q2 and point P is at a position given by vector R sub 2 relative to charge Q. Similarly, charge 3 and P is given at a position vector R sub 3 relative to charge 3, and Q sub n, where P is at a distance, a displacement given by R sub n vector relative to Q, the position of Qn. Each of these charges independently, if I were to imagine each of these charges in turn to be by themselves in the universe, and I calculated how much work it would take to move a charge from infinity, where the potential, absolute potential, is defined as zero, to the position in space given by point P, each of these charges, the amount of work per unit charge it would take to do that would be K times Q sub I over R sub I, where R sub I is the distance from point P to that particular charge. the total work it takes for the distribution is going to be the amount of work it takes for each of these, relative to each of these charges, summed up. So it's just a scalar sum, and that's the power. Remember, if we did this for electric field or electric force, it's a vector sum, and vectors are hard because you're always having to take direction into account. It becomes a hard problem. But in this case, I only need to know the distance, the radial distance, from each charge to point P, and that gives me each of the terms, and I just sum it up like a scalar, just numbers. So the potential at point P is the sum of the individual potentials due to each of the charges algebraically. And you get KQ sub I over R sub I, the sum over each of the charges. So let's go to page 12. Now I'd like to consider a continuous charge distribution. So imagine that we have some potato distribution of charge, which has an arbitrary position in space, whatever, and I consider a point P that is could be inside the charge or outside the charge, doesn't matter, I've drawn it outside the charge, and that point P is given, if I were to choose a little element of charge within this distribution, which I'll call dQ, then relative to dQ, the point P is at a distance r from dQ. Well, the potential at point P due to dQ is going to be a differential dP. You can imagine if I had all the other charge in the universe removed except for this little dQ, and I then ask, how much work does it take to move a charge from infinity to point P, then it will be kQ over r, but it's not q, remember, it's a dQ. And instead of thinking of it as work, because dQ is so little, you think of it as differential work, because dQ is so tiny, it doesn't take much work to bring it there. So if I have differential work per unit charge, then that would be differential potential. So you can imagine that the potential at point P due to dQ will really call dV sub P, or the differential potential. So if we look at the equation signified by the A in the pink A in a circle, you have dVP is equal to k dQ over r, or the differential potential at point P due to effective point charge dQ. Now we integrate, so we sum over all of the dQs in this continuous distribution, and we get the equation outlined in red marker. V sub B, the potential at point V sub P, the potential at point P, is the integral over the entire charge volume of K dQ over R. And remember that dQ we usually will look at as rho dV, so we can integrate over the volume of the charge, whatever the charge distribution happens to be. And as you've seen, of course, that I could make that arbitrarily complex. But I'd like you to keep in mind that the potential here is a scalar. So what that means is that this integral will very often be much less complex than the relevant integral for the electric field in terms of calculation. Remember, the electric field integral involves direction. It's 1 over r squared, and that can complicate things, and it includes the r hat, so you have direction in there, and that complicates things. So the electric field integrals are often quite nasty. I can, of course, make a potential integral. That is quite nasty, but it is inherently usually simpler to do because just 1 over r and there's no direction at all. So this is part of the reason that we're wasting our time talking about potential, because it is a, well, okay, we'll come back to that, in fact, in a moment. Now, we have seen that if I move a charge from point from A to B in an electric field, for example, that what we've seen in the example of a point charge, that it depends only on the radii. That is, it depends only on the end positions relative to charge Q. If the energy of a system, or the potential energy in a system, or work within a system depends only on the endpoints, we say that it is a conservative force. And this is very powerful, because it means it doesn't matter what path I use to move from one point to another. I only need to have information on the endpoints to calculate changes in energy. This is very powerful, and this is exactly the thing that makes that allows us to do good calculations in gravitation and springs. It makes consideration of potential energy to be a very important and valid thing to do. I would not know what the energy is in a system if it took different amounts of energy for me to move a charge from one point to another depending on the path that I took. Okay, so if friction were involved, for example, depending on what path you take, you use up different amounts of energy to get it from point A to point B. And then that makes energy not so very useful constraint on the problem. It doesn't really help you out. But lacking that, consideration of energy can be really useful. The change in potential, remember, goes as work, and the work it takes to move a charge from one point to another, and that goes as the dot product of F dot ds, and this dot product projects out, in the point charge example, the radial component of the path displacements that I make. So it doesn't matter how much I move transverse to the radii. The dot product is only projecting out the radial movement. And so this is what basically turns your work calculation into a path-independent piece. So this turns out to be very important for us. Now, we've talked a lot about potential, and now what I'd like to do is to give you an idea of why potential is so very important for us. We've discovered that, in principle, calculating the potential is much easier than calculating an electric field. But why does that help us? Because we still don't have the electric field. What we have is the potential, right? And in the end, as a physicist, I sort of want to know electric fields, because if I know electric fields, I can determine forces. If I can determine forces, I can determine the history or the future of a given thing, which is, in a sense, what we mean by understanding it well, or a way to think of understanding it well. So let us imagine a situation on page 14 where we have an electric field which is constrained to be constant and along the x direction. And let us say that we have a charge Q0 that moves from point A to point B. Okay, then the work that the system does in moving this charge from point A to point B is going to be equal to F dot dx, the integral of F dot dx. F is going to be Q times E, and F and dx are along the same direction if I choose x to be in the direction shown. So the total work that the system does is going to be Q0 times E times the integral of E dot dx. Well, E is along x, so the work per unit charge is if the work per unit charge is going to just be the integral of E dx, because I'm dividing out the Q0. So the potential is going to be E dx. And it's a differential potential because I'm moving in a differential distance dx. The work that the system is doing is going to be minus EDX. How do I say that? Sorry, I have to think for a moment. This is a subtlety, and I want to make sure that I say it right. Oh, okay. The work that the charge has done on it is positive. Okay, if it's a positive charge in an electric field and I let it go, when it goes from A to B, it's going to have a kinetic energy because there'll be a force on it, okay? If you ask, so that's the work done on the charge. So if you ask what is the work done on the system, it's the opposite of that, so it's negative. So that there's a sign convention that I'm trying to motivate here. The change in potential goes as minus the electric field dx. So what this leads is to determine that the electric field along the x direction is the change in the potential with respect to dx. So the electric field is going to the right, for example, and I know that it takes me work to move a charge from point A to point B, for example, against the electric field. So this is the origin of that minus sign, basically, in order to get the direction of the electric field right and associate it to how much work it takes to put into the system. You get this, you get the minus sign. So what you see is that there is a relationship between the electric field in a given direction and the rate of change of the potential in that direction. We chose a very particular example which has only an x dependence. If I could imagine considering something along a radius or along y or along z, so the formulation that we have just done is actually independent of what the variable is. So outlined in red at the bottom of page 14 is an equation that you'll find to be very useful, which is that the electric field along some direction S is equal to minus the derivative, or the rate of change, of the potential along that direction, or with respect to that direction. Okay, so E sub S is equal to minus the derivative of the potential with respect to S. So let's go to page 15. Now, the equation at the bottom of page 14 is really relevant if you have a dependence on the potential that depends only on one variable. Of course, the real world is not so simple. Okay, the real world works in three variables. Sometimes Cartesian coordinates are useful, sometimes cylindrical, sometimes spherical polar. So let us imagine a Cartesian dependence to the potential. We have some Cartesian coordinate system, and I have given you a function of how the potential changes in that system as a function of x, y, and z. Why might I give you such a thing? How would I determine it? Well, I could imagine taking a charge and moving it around and figuring out how much work it takes to move it from point to point, so that it's relatively simple for me to construct such a function. What I would like in the end, as we have seen so far in this class, is to determine what is the electric field. Well, if I want the full electric field vector, I can calculate the electric field components and combine them into a full vector. So, in principle, you can imagine that the electric field along the x direction on the second line on page 15 is equal to minus the derivative of the potential with respect to x. That's basically the formula that we saw at the bottom of page 14. Similarly, the electric field along the y is equal to minus the derivative of v with respect to y, and the electric field along the z is equal to minus the derivative of v with respect to z. There's a little bit of a problem here, though, because v does not depend only on x, or only on y, or only on z, but v is a multidimensional function that has a dependence on all three variables. So, this gives me a bit of a problem. And mathematics has a way of dealing with it, which I'm sure many of you have seen. Some of you may not have seen yet. We define something which is known as a partial derivative. The partial derivative of a function is equal to the derivative of the function where all of the variables except one are treated as if they are constant. So I show you how to write this in the middle of page 15, where I have a pink A in a circle. E sub x is not the normal derivative of v with respect to x, but it is, or minus the normal derivative, it is minus the partial derivative of v with respect to x. You can, notation-wise, the difference is given by the d's become sort of little curlicues, as shown in the equation with the pink circle A, or down at the bottom of page 15. It's very important that you learn to use these curlicues in your physics, because they look way cooler than the d's. I mean, the problem is your grandma can look at normal derivatives, and she's seen d's before, so they don't surprise her. But nobody ever sees these little curlicues for partials. So when you start throwing around partial differential equations, it looks way more impressive. So I want you to make sure that you get really good at writing partial derivatives. Okay, very important. So, what is the partial derivative? It is nothing more than a normal derivative calculation with respect to a single variable, but you treat all of the other variables in the expression, other than that one, as if they were constants, which you know what to do with constants in a derivative. So I think an example will be useful for this. If we go to page 16, imagine that I have a function, some arbitrary function of x, y, and z, which is, not arbitrary, I'm giving it to you. It's 2x squared times y times z cubed. The partial derivative of this function with respect to x, well, you take the derivative of the x piece, which is going to be 2x, and you multiply it by the other constants in the expression, which, because I'm doing a partial derivative, y and z are treated as constants. So I take the 2, the y, and the z cubed, and I pull them through the derivative as if they were constants, and I take the derivative of x squared, which is 2x. So I end up with 4 times x times y times z cubed. I take the partial derivative of v with respect to y. Again, I put the 2x squared z cubed are treated as constants, and the derivative of y is just 1. So the answer is 2x squared z cubed. And in the third formula to the right, the partial derivative of v with respect to z is treating 2x squared y as constants. I pull them out, and the derivative of z cubed is 3z squared. And I multiply that all out, and I get 6x squared y z squared. For this given function, if it has n variables, there will be n partial derivatives. You can think of the partial derivatives for if you are at some position x, y, and z in the function. The partial derivative with respect to x basically gives you the slope in the x direction for that particular function. And the partial derivative with respect to y sort of gives you the slope in the y direction. The partial derivative with respect to z gives you the slope in the z direction. And just to give you a sense of where we're headed with this, if we go back to page 15, if I have a potential function in electrostatics, which is depends on, say, for example, x, y, and z, the electric field in the x direction is going to be minus the partial derivative of v with respect to x. And the electric field in the y direction is going to be minus the partial derivative of v in the y direction, or with respect to y. And the electric field along the z direction is going to be minus the partial derivative of v with respect to the z. So we're going to come back to this because, as I said earlier, the potential is often something that's much easier to calculate than what you're used to with electric fields or forces because it doesn't contain direction. It's just a scalar. Once I have the potential function, then the question is, can I get the field from it? And you can by using the fact that the electric field effectively is the rate of change or the gradient, if you will, of the potential in different directions. And I'll come back and give you some more formalism on that next Tuesday. So I hope you found that this audio file is not too monotonic and puts you to sleep. At any rate, I hope it works well for you. I'll be asking you for some feedback about how it worked. I mean, I could arrange to have a guest lecturer instead of doing this, but in some ways this is a lot simpler. And hopefully you've managed to listen to this in your jammies and it hasn't put you to sleep. So I hope you've enjoyed it. At any rate, I'll see you next Tuesday, and have a great weekend.